It's called presidential harassment.
I want nothing.
And it's unfortunate.
I want no quid pro quo.
This should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly. He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney. Yeah, sure.
Shut up,
Rudy.
Shut up.
Okay, hold on.
Shut up.
You don't know
what you're talking about.
What they've done to General Flynn.
Russia, Russia, Russia.
What they've done to others.
It was all bull.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney, and former federal prosecutor. He writes the Popehat Report, which you can subscribe to on Substack. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So the president has coronavirus, which is not great, and he was hospitalized at Walter Reed Hospital on Friday, but he took a little joyride around Bethesda, Maryland on Sunday, and then on Monday he checked himself out to return to the White House. So I've seen a lot of people saying, why did the hospital let him leave? Why did his doctors let him go? Now, Trump is in this highly unusual situation where he's the commander-in-chief, and this is a military hospital, so his whole medical team ultimately takes orders from him. But even if you're a regular patient, if you have an infectious disease and you've been hospitalized for it, do your doctors have the legal authority to keep you at the hospital?
Yes, there are various local jurisdiction laws that would allow medical officials to quarantine forcibly somebody who is has an infectious disease. But it's extremely unlikely that it's going to be employed against somebody who controls the 82nd Airborne. And I think that it's probably a bridge too far to use it against a high official like that. The history of all those is also pretty spotty. I mean, there's been a lot of enthusiasm, some of it from me, for the concept that we should employ criminal laws and other coercive measures when people are risking other people's safety by acting irresponsibly when they have COVID. But the truth is that the history of all those laws and their use is pretty grim, and they're generally have been employed to the detriment of traditionally discriminated against groups. And we see that a lot in the way that such laws have been used during the AIDS crisis or another health crises, generally against groups that have suffered discrimination and against the poorest of us.
But aside from criminal approaches here, aren't there civil law approaches where either, you know, you can fine people into quarantine or where you could have some sort of civil liability? I mean, like, could people who may have gotten COVID at what appears to be a super spreading event at the White House or who have good reason to believe that they got COVID from the president, could they sue him in civil court?
Well, of course, anyone can sue anyone, but they would have a hard time getting anywhere prevailing. There you'd have a mishmash of the president's general traditional immunity from suit for most things that he does in his capacity as president, the Federal Tort Claims Act and all the extreme limitations it puts on suing people for things they do in their capacity as federal officials or employees, and the general limits that already exist on the laws that might put people in civil liability for failing to take adequate disease measures. So it's a very cloudy area of the law, even before you try to impose it onto the context of the president doing things. So that's a long-winded way to say that it would be really difficult for anyone to try.
We've talked about the Federal Tort Claims Act in the context of E. Jean Carroll's defamation lawsuit against the president. She's a person who has accused the president of rape. He denied her accusation in a way that was especially gross, and she sued him for defamation for accusing her of being a liar. And the issue with the Federal Tort Claims Act is that it allows the federal government to step into the shoes of a federal government employee who might be sued over a tort. But then there are certain things that you can't actually obtain a judgment against the government for, and one of those is defamation. So if the government gets into Trump's shoes in that suit, then she will have no relief. But what about if the president gave you COVID? Could the federal government be on the hook for that under the Federal Tort Claims Act? Could they be the one that would have to pay you to compensate you?
So there's not a general prohibition on disease-related claims in the Federal Tort Claims Act the way there is for defamation claims. However, the law is poorly developed on whether or not that type of negligence or recklessness could be a basis for liability. So the answer again is that it would be an uphill battle trying to apply it in this type of situation.
What if you work at the White House or if you're a Secret Service agent and you've been required as a job responsibility to get into a hermetically sealed vehicle with the president, ordinarily designed to keep threats out of the vehicle, but in this case, the threat is coming from inside the vehicle. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration ordinarily regulates workplaces against impermissible hazards. Could you get relief from OSHA? Could you make an OSHA complaint and say, I have been irresponsibly and recklessly exposed to this infectious disease at my workplace in the federal government?
I think that that's going to be difficult for Secret Service agents who, after all, by the nature of their job, are supposed to expose themselves to extreme risks in the course of protecting the president. Now, of course, normally those risks aren't supposed to be from the president. You don't buy on to the Secret Service with the concept that the president may decide to kill you in any minute. But the bottom line is that somebody's got to protect the president, even when he's sick, and it's going to be a hard sell under existing legal structures for the Secret Service to say they shouldn't have to be doing that when the president's extremely sick. Now, I do think that you can make an argument, like you said, that the president and the people approving what he was doing gratuitously exposed Secret Service agents to unnecessarily extreme risk. And really, Josh, I don't know how that's going to turn out. This is, you know, bizarre situations, historic situations sometimes produce new, unpredictable law. And I think that the existing law on this type of thing is very cloudy, and it's just not clear how it'll turn out. But you could definitely imagine this type of situation being what creates new precedent.
People have been talking a lot about HIPAA over the last week or so. And Ken, would you say the HIPAA discourse is smarter than the usual discourse that we have around the RICO Act?
It's stupider, Josh, because at least when people type RICO, they get the initials right. HIPAA, they generally get wrong. You know, HIPAA, of course, is a law that protects you from having healthcare providers gratuitously disclose your private health information. But online, generally people seem to think that it prevents anyone from talking about the health of the president, which it does not. It only applies to healthcare professionals who get your healthcare information in the course of providing healthcare services. It does not apply generally to people talking about other people's health or to employers talking about it or do other third parties talking about it?
Yeah, HIPAA stands for Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. So it has one P and two A's. So if you're going to make some ludicrous claims on Twitter about what is a violation of HIPAA, please make sure to spell it that way. It's not spelled like a hippopotamus. As you note, people bring this up to complain about media coverage of the president, but we've also had direct statements about his health status from his medical providers. They've held press conferences. And there was this sort of odd thing where you had the president's doctor out there in front of Walter Reed, and he would talk about the president's kidney function and his liver function, but then asked about the president's lung function, he would say, oh, I'm not allowed to disclose that because of HIPAA. So does HIPAA only apply to adverse information? Is your doctor free to tell people positive facts about your health, and he's only restricted if there are negative facts about your health?
Well, it should apply to positive facts about your health, too, if you don't want them disclosed. I mean, you can waive HIPAA. You can, someone like the president can certainly authorize medical professionals to release information for reasons, for instance, just to inspire confidence in the public. But when a doctor says that, what they're really saying is that the president has authorized certain information and not others to be disclosed. And it's perfectly legitimate to ask that if the president is allowing some medical information to be disclosed, but not others, what is that? And what is it that he has chosen not to disclose?
We got some breaking news on Wednesday morning, just as we were about to tape this show. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a trial court's ruling that Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance could proceed with a subpoena to obtain President Trump's tax records from his accountants. They basically said the president's argument about this subpoena being supposedly overbroad just didn't make any sense. So the president, I guess, is expected to appeal this ruling to the Supreme Court. When will we know if the Supreme Court is going to agree to hear that appeal?
Hopefully relatively quickly. So there's a timeline within which they have to petition the Supreme Court for review. And then the Supreme Court has generally months to make that decision. But one hopes that under these circumstances, the court's going to make that call sooner rather than later. However, it's perfectly plausible that we won't know what the Supreme Court is doing, and therefore we won't have a live order until after the election.
And then, assuming that the Supreme Court declines to take this case, and I think you think that's the most likely thing, right, that they won't hear it?
Yes, because the issues at hand are not complex federal issues or novel issues or special issues. By the Supreme Court's own instructions, they are just straightforward application of existing state and federal law to the president as if he were any other litigant. So the trial court and court of appeals call on those are definitely not the type of thing that the Supreme Court generally accepts to review. And if it did, that would fairly strongly indicate a political interest in interfering with the process.
So assuming that sooner or later this is going to go Cy Vance's way, he will obtain these records, but we don't know what he's going to do with them. They will be secret when he obtains them, and we don't know how far along he is in an investigation or even precisely what he is investigating.
Right. So this is a situation where we shouldn't know anything more substantive anytime soon, even if the subpoena now goes through and the DA gets the information they're looking for. If they're ready to indict, then they're ready to indict, and this additional stuff shouldn't make a big difference. If they're not ready to indict, then this is secret grand jury information and should not be released to the public absent some sort of highly illegal leak. So it's not the sort of thing that's actually going to result in a quick release of information that would move votes.
A setback for Cy Vance is that another judge threw out a case that he brought against Paul Manafort. This was basically a case brought as insurance against a pardon. In case the president pardoned Manafort for the various federal crimes that he was convicted of, that they would try him in state court because the frauds he committed that were federal crimes were also state law violations. But we sort of expected this. The New York has a double jeopardy law that would have prevented prosecuting Manafort in state court for the same acts he'd already been prosecuted for in federal court. And so it was a real tough argument that Cy Vance should be able to bring this case?
Well, exactly. So remember that under federal law, the Supreme Court has held that the double jeopardy clause of the United States Constitution doesn't prevent parallel prosecutions by the feds and the state for similar conduct. So you can do it without violating the federal constitution. However, a number of states, New York among them, have laws that say in our state you can't prosecute something for something the feds have already prosecuted them for. That's what happened here. Vance's office went after Manafort for a series of charges related to alleged bank fraud that was most charitably parallel to what the feds had already done to him. And this judge is just saying, no, you can't do that under New York law. This is prohibited by the law.
Quickly, before we go to break, Ken, is it RICO?
You're going to have to be way more specific what you're talking about in 2020, Josh. Is what RICO?
I don't know. Did Antifa do the RICO?
I think it was HIPAA. HIPAA did the RICO.
Oh, HIPAA did the RICO. Okay.
Yes.
I'm asking Ken about this because now we have a new way to tell everyone, to remind everyone, to reassure everyone that no, it is still not RICO. And you don't even have to say a word. Just pin one of our new All the President's Lawyers Not RICO enamel pins to your lapel. And if someone asks you if Antifa did the RICO, you can just smile politely through gritted teeth, resolve to have an extra dram of bonus whiskey later on as a treat, and get on with your day. Right, Ken?
Absolutely. And the pins also include Josh's face. And no worries, not my face, a stylized hat. So you're good for any reference you want to make to the show.
And one that says good lawyer. If you wear a pin that says good lawyer after being disbarred, are you illegally practicing law?
I think the answer would be that it's ironic, and irony is generally legal for now.
So anyway, these pins, they are pretty great. KCRW's fall fundraising drive began this week, and we know you all picked up our fucking amazing swear jars last year. So now it's time for new swag, and it's these pins. It's a set of four. As Ken mentioned, Not Rico, Good Lawyer, the Pope Hat pin, and My Face. You can have My Face right on your lapel. To get serious for a minute and less deranged, sorry, this is such a deranged pitch. It's, this is a weird October. Please help. But if you love this show, please consider becoming a member of KCRW, the public radio station that makes and distributes our show. They need your support. It's a critical time for everyone, including public radio stations, and we know that you may not be in a position to give right now, and that's okay. But if you are, please consider becoming a KCRW member and picking up a set of these pins, or just make a donation, and please know that your support means a lot to us. You can do all of that at kcrw.com/give. As always, leave a comment and let KCRW know that you're becoming a member to support all the president's lawyers, or left, right, and center. We love to thank as many of you as we can on upcoming episodes. And maybe we'll do a fun stunt to thank you if we really get a strong showing. Do you have thoughts or ideas? Let us know in the comments when you give, or you can just harass Ken about it on Twitter. When we come back, we'll talk about everybody's favorite, Eric Trump. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. So Eric Trump sat for a video deposition in the civil investigation into the Trump Organization that is being conducted by New York Attorney General Letitia James. He tried to delay this deposition until after the election on the grounds that he's very busy and that Letitia James is being so political here, but a judge ordered him to be deposed before October 7. So Ken, are we going to learn what's in this deposition? Because unlike grand jury material, this is not secret, right? So can Tish James tell us what Eric Trump said?
Well, it's not secret in the sense that it's not prohibited by law from being released. However, I suspect that the Attorney General will not simply put it out there or make gratuitous public statements about it. Here's why. Doing so would play into the Trump Organization's arguments that the court should limit the scope of the investigation. In other words, if the Attorney General conducts a deposition like this and, contrary to normal practice, just throws the videotape of it out there, then that's going to make it much easier for the Trump Organization to convince a judge that this is in bad faith or that there are privacy issues that ought to be respected, or that there should be limits put on the scope of the investigation. So, absent it being leaked, I don't think you're likely to see just generalized releases of it prior to any action being taken. Now, in further litigation over the scope, I could definitely see us getting some excerpts of it in the form of maybe quotes from it or anything else in pleadings back and forth that argue over the scope of what the Attorney General should be allowed to do or what has or hasn't been found.
This is not a criminal investigation. So what sort of actions might we ultimately see here in which we as the public would learn something about what the AG has been looking into?
Well, it's true that it's not a criminal investigation, but I would put fairly heavy air quotes around that because certainly components of state and local New York authorities are criminally investigating the Trump Organization and people related to it, and it would be trivially easy for them to turn this information over from the left hand to the right hand that's doing the criminal investigation. And that's not unusual in parallel proceedings and parallel investigations like this. That said, the Attorney General has a set of administrative and civil duties and remedies that they can go after, and those include administrative orders to charities and other groups, and civil remedies like penalties and fines and injunctions, things like that. Those are the types of things that I think you might see, but I think the real action will be if they turn this stuff over to anyone from District Attorney Vance to other people within the Attorney General's office conducting criminal investigations to anyone else.
The U.S. government is suing former National Security Advisor John Bolton. It's trying to obtain the proceeds from his book, The Room Where It Happened, on the grounds that Bolton breached a non-disclosure agreement that required him to complete a pre-publication review to check the book for classified information before he published it. Now, Bolton claimed the government was interpreting this confidentiality agreement much too broadly, that their interpretation would require him to seek their approval even if he wanted to publish a cookbook. But Judge Royce Lamberth said Bolton is free to publish a cookbook so long as it doesn't consist of recipes from CIA sources and operatives. He's allowing this lawsuit to go forward. So, I mean, Ken, first of all, I should note that Royce Lamberth is possibly the perfect name for a judge.
It really is. It's like learned hand. It's perfect.
So Bolton is on weak legal ground here, right?
He is. He's trying to get it dismissed. And at that stage of a federal proceedings, the question is, if everything in the complaint is true, is that enough to keep going? And that's a very easy standard usually to beat unless there are serious legal flaws in your argument. And what the judge said here was that although the language of some of these contracts was not as clear as it could have been, it is clear enough that when information is related to secret sources and methods, that that's enough to trigger the obligations for pre-publication review that Bolton ultimately did not follow. And so because it's the complaint alleges that some of the materials in the book are related to these sources and methods, that makes it something that can go on to discovery to find out whether or not it's true that that's the content of the book.
Reality Winner is a former U.S. intelligence specialist who's currently in prison for leaking a classified U.S. government report on Russian efforts to hack U.S. election infrastructure. And now Michael Cohen is working with her. He's working alongside an attorney in an effort to obtain her compassionate release. And we talked earlier about whether you can wear a good lawyer pin if you're not a lawyer anymore. Michael Cohen has been disbarred. So what exactly is he doing here if not lawyering?
Well, that's a fair question. Generally, the unlicensed practice of law is prohibited. So it's absolutely clear that Michael Cohen couldn't appear in court on somebody's behalf. He couldn't draft legal documents. Where it becomes more sticky is when he's giving advice. If he's giving legal advice, which means applying the law to specific factual situations, that would seem to be unauthorized practice of law. But if he's giving political advice about how to seek favorable treatment, who to talk to, and the best messages to send, that may be outside the scope of what prohibited unauthorized practice of law would be. I mean, frankly, it's not clear to me that Michael Cohen has the legal background to be helping Reality Winner with legal issues. But with political issues as a fixer, he may be ideally suited to be giving her legal team advice about the best way to, well, politically fix something. And political advice is not something that violates the prohibition on unauthorized practice of law.
Is Michael Cohen qualified to give political advice? I mean, the fixing stuff didn't work out so well for him.
In the long run, no. I can see how it turned out to be less than ideal. But I mean, we got to look at it that, you know, he was the fixer for someone who became the president of the United States. And I think his fixing successfully suppressed information that may have had a role in Trump becoming the president of the United States. And the fact that the whole house of cards fell down later doesn't mean he didn't have some political acumen.
Speaking of houses of cards that fall down, Michael Avenatti has lost one of his three federal criminal trials, and he's preparing for the second one to be held in Orange County, California, for matters including stealing a multi-million dollar settlement from a disabled client. And so, Ken, I guess he's still fighting with the government over several pretrial matters, including whether he violated the terms of his pretrial release and should therefore be sent back to prison as he waits for this trial?
Yeah, I mean, the briefing in this case between the U.S. Attorney's Office and Michael Avenatti's lawyers is, I think, unusually contentious and nasty. And I mean, we're talking about people's freedom. The briefing can often get contentious and nasty, but here it's really bickering, and it's pretty clear the judge is not a fan of what's going on. But the U.S. Attorney's Office is trying to get him remanded to custody. And remember, he was let out because of COVID temporarily, and saying basically that he used computers connected to the internet despite the prohibition on him doing that. They're also fighting on what type of evidence will come into the trial on the charges here in California. Recall, he's charged with various federal crimes related to allegedly defrauding and stealing from clients, tax fraud, and so forth. And so there's a complex set of laws that governs when you're accused of doing federal crimes A, B, and C, whether the government can also put in evidence that you also did D, E, and F. You can't just generally gratuitously put in this guy's a bad crime person who does crimes all the time, but you can bring in evidence of other bad acts when they help prove your intent or a plan or a motive or legitimate issues of proof like that. So that's one of the things basically that the parties are bickering over here, which is Michael Avenatti has done a lot of bad stuff. And the question is how much of that gets to come into this case, which is only about some of that bad stuff. So it's a complex and very contentious set of motions.
Finally, Jacob Wohl and Jack Berkman. Ken and I have been following the borderline illegal travails of Jacob Wohl and Jack Berkman. Their thing is staging elaborate but very poorly planned stunts that are intended to embarrass usually Democratic politicians like Elizabeth Warren, whom they called a cougar. They got a guy to claim to have had some torrid affair with Elizabeth Warren that was obviously false. And so their latest really stupid thing is that they've been indicted in the state of Michigan for illegally placing robocalls aimed at Black voters, urging them, well, why don't we just play the robocall?
Hi, this is Tamika Taylor from Project 1599, the civil rights organization founded by Jack Berkman and Jacob Wohl. Mail-in voting sounds great. But did you know that if you vote by mail, your personal information will be part of a public database that will be used by police departments to track down old warrants and be used by credit card companies to collect outstanding debts? The CDC is even pushing to use records for mail-in voting to track people for mandatory vaccines. Don't be finessed into giving your private information to the man. Stay safe and beware of vote by mail.
Ken, if you engage in a scheme to place illegal voter suppression robocalls, should you put your name in the script?
No, you should not. I know I say on the show a lot of ifs or buts or maybes or depends. I'm going to come really out strong here and say don't sign your crimes. I feel confident doing that without qualification. Also, if you do sign your crimes, don't, when your crimes come to light, then say, oh no, this is a Democratic dirty trick. We weren't associated with that, because that's what is known in the business as consciousness of guilt. So yeah, don't do this. But Josh, I have a gripe. I have a grievance. We keep saying that Jacob Wohl will eventually do a big boy federal crime. Now, you know, when he was charged with a securities-related issue in California, he said, okay, that's thematically sort of like federal, but it's not federal. Now here in Michigan, he's charged with crimes that have to do with some interstate elements, but it's still not federal. Josh, when I say federal, I mean federal. And I'm getting a little upset with Jacob Wohl that he won't just go federal. That does not mean just going from state to state criming. Federal crime, it's not like Pokemon. You don't collect all the state crimes first. You just go straight to federal. And I don't know. It's almost enough to make me think that he's going to be jailed in one of the various states before he can get around to a federal crime. But then I cheer myself up and I think, no, Jacob, you can do it. I believe in you.
Well, but so to get serious for a moment, we talked about this prior stunt where they staged a fake FBI raid on Jack Berkman's home, and we were trying to figure out whether that was a federal crime. Had they, in fact, impersonated federal officers within the meaning of the federal statute, and that was unclear. And we also discussed the possibility that they committed wire fraud by promising to pay these actors $400 for their role in this scheme, and then at least as of the time of the fake raid, not actually making good on that payment. that? Was that wire fraud against those actors? And what you said was, you know, quite possibly yes, but that's not the sort of thing that a federal prosecutor would ever bother with. So even if it's technically a federal crime, it's not one that Jacob stands any reasonable chance of being prosecuted for. So it was not a good performance on his part. What about these facts here about these robocalls? Is this something that might actually seriously interest a federal prosecutor in addition to these state prosecutors in Michigan?
Probably not, because these are violations of state criminal laws related to intimidation of voters. So the Michigan charges, Josh, have one count of basically intimidating voters through these calls. And then the other counts are all just sort of riffs on that. You've got conspiracy and you've got using computers to commit other crimes. So it all really boils down to the intimidating voters. And the feds generally don't charge that, although there are some federal statutes that could hypothetically be stretched to cover it. So I still think likely here we're not dealing with something that's likely to go federal. We're still looking for that. We're still waiting for the day, but the day will come. I believe the day will come.
Keep at it, Jacob. We have faith in you. There's much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production fellow is Victoria Alejandro. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.